Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the program. My name is Simon Barrett, and joining me this week to analyze the current events from the past week are, from Youngstown, Ohio, author, activist, and barkeep Sam Moffey. Sam, welcome.
Thank you, Simon. Looking forward to talk everything from soup to nuts on Super Bowl Sunday.
Is Bill's Place ready for the Pop Bowl? Do you have enough chicken wings and beer?
Yeah, chicken wings at the bar tonight. I don't know what my lovely wife's going to make. Probably a smorgasbord of leftovers. Open up a bottle of wine, build a fire, and hope that it's a good game. And I'm torn between. I really like to see Peyton Manning win a Super Bowl and put all the doubters to bed for him. And the same token, I'd kind of like the Seattle Seahawks because they've never really won much and they never won one. So I'm just hoping for a good game, and whatever will be, will be.
And from the City of Angels, we're joined by Ace Attorney Peter Haven. Peter, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here, and happy Super Bowl Sunday to everyone. I hope it's a safe and sane day for everyone.
Okay. Obviously, Sam has waxed lyrical on the Super Bowl. Peter, do you have a favorite going into tonight's game?
Oh, I think everybody is sort of in the Peyton Manning bandwagon. They all want to see him get another Super Bowl so that, you know, he doesn't go down as the greatest quarterback in NFL history who only won one game, one Super Bowl. So I think most people are siding with the Broncos. I feel like I'm going in that direction too. And these Seahawks, they're sure an ornery bunch. It must be the Seattle weather. I don't know.
Well, either that or it's the marijuana.
Well, maybe that too. Who knows?
Okay.
Well, it's interesting. These are both of these states legalized marijuana, and immediately they find themselves in the Super Bowl. Maybe there's a cause and effect there. I don't know.
Could very well be. Okay, let's move on to a story that I just find fascinating. It's the Amanda Knox story. Here in the U.S., laws do indeed change from state to state. You know, good example is marijuana. It's legal in Colorado. It's less legal in other places. But certain major principles remain constant. For better or for worse, we have the concept of double jeopardy. You know, once found not guilty, neither the state nor the feds cannot have a second bite at the same cherry. But that is not the case in other countries. The Amanda Knox case is curious. Italy found her guilty of murder, and then a higher court reversed the verdict. Amanda, just like I would have done, hightailed it out of the country and has crossed Italy off her list of neat places to visit. Italian prosecutors, however, have tried the case a second time. Amanda was in absentia, as I would be, and once again, a guilty verdict has been returned, and a sentence of 28 and a half years imposed. Peter, obviously you're not an expert on international law, but from your heart, do you think that it is fair to go through double jeopardy?
Well, as a general rule, no. I I don't think it's fair to go through double jeopardy, and that's why I favor double jeopardy laws here. I guess if I understand the way the case transpired is she was initially found guilty. Now, in America, if you're found guilty, you have the right to appeal that verdict. That is a criminal defendant's right. If you're found not guilty, the prosecution has no right to appeal because that would implicate double jeopardy. The case ends if you're found not guilty. If you are a defendant and you're found guilty, the defendant has the right to appeal. It's unclear to me exactly what happened here in Italy. I don't know why the matter was on appeal if the system is similar to that in the United States and someone would have to initiate the appeal. Perhaps the appellate court in Italy just interjected itself, as we would say, sua sponte, and decided on its own what it was going to do, and then I guess overturned the verdict and remanded is probably what happened, and that resulted in some sort of new trial process. But the whole thing is very confusing to me, and as a general rule, I do think it's unfair to subject someone to criminal prosecution twice for the same crime by the same jurisdiction.
Well, you know, I read the Amanda Knox story, and I have to admit that there are a couple of cases I could cite where I really wish that double jeopardy was not on the table in the U.S. Obviously, the two cases that I'm thinking about are O.J. Simpson and Casey Anthony. Boy, I would have loved to have seen prosecutors take a second swipe at those.
Well, yeah. I mean, the theory behind double jeopardy, the theory is that there are many theories behind it, but one of the basic theories is that, you know, the government is a very powerful force. They're armed with all kinds of personnel, money, resources, and that when someone is prosecuted by the state, that process of being prosecuted is a very grueling ordeal. And since the state presumably specializes in prosecution and it has law enforcement authorities and prosecutors and all, as I said, all kinds of resources, since the state has so much resources to devote to this compared to the individual, and since they presumably have so much experience and expertise in doing this, that the state only gets one crack. It can't just keep subjecting someone to the tremendous burden of a full-blown prosecution over and over again. It gets one shot, and if it fails, and a failure is defined as a not guilty verdict, if it fails, then they don't get another shot. A failure does not include a hung jury. So if the jury's hung, the prosecution does get the chance to recommence the trial, and it can choose to do so or not choose to do so. But, you know, that's the theory, and there are you see exceptions where you wish perhaps that the double jeopardy rule did not apply because of, for example, someone like Simpson. But, you know, overall, the fairness component is such that it's just not feasible to have a system. It's not feasible to protect people's individual rights and have a system where there are exceptions to double jeopardy. You know, the state gets one chance. They've got to do it right in America, and they're not going to get a second chance, at least not directly. There are other ways to achieve justice, as we've talked about before, but not by way of criminal prosecution for the exact same offense. Now, interestingly, people may remember the Rodney King trials, and in the Rodney King trials, state police officers were put on trial by state prosecutors, and that trial ended in a not guilty verdict, and riots ensued. Subsequently, the federal government, they were prosecuted in federal courts for a violation of civil liberties, and I believe two of them were found guilty in that context. So it doesn't apply to separate jurisdictions or separate, although seemingly related cases. It just applies in the case of same jurisdiction, same crime.
And Sam, obviously you have been watching the Amanda Knox story. What's your take on it?
Actually, I haven't been watching that much of it. You know, the other night when it was the lead story, talk about a slow news day, it was all over the place. I mean, Anderson Cooper spent a whole special on one of those slow news days. And my wife and I were watching the television. We decided to see if we watched the news in a while, and it was all Amanda Knox all the time. And I've come to the conclusion, I think it was a threesome that went bad based upon what I've seen and read about and this and that. And I thought it's pretty much the legal ramifications of it much better than I can. I just find it interesting is once the appeals process is gone through, if the Italian court still finds her guilty, will they ask for formal extradition of the United States, and how is that going to play out? That's number one. And number two, Peter, I have the question for you is Amanda Knox must be related to Paul Allen or the Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg, because where's she coming up for the dough for all these lawyers?
Well, I get the feeling there's not much that legally is going on for her right now. I mean, whatever she went through during the first trial was whatever she went through, and as soon as she had the opportunity to leave Italy, she left and came back to the States. And I personally don't think she's invested a cent in lawyers, because she's decided to have nothing to do with the system, and she's relying on the fact that the finding of innocence or not guilty would be upheld, or in the alternative, even if they found her guilty, which is where we're at now, she wouldn't come back to Italy, and presumably she believes she'll be able to escape justice in that matter. I don't think she had much choice, because it's not like, as you pointed out, I don't think she could afford to go back to Italy and fight.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you on that. I just said when I was watching Anderson Cooper talk and try to dissect the case, they had a quote from the Knox legal team that said they will fight all extradition, you know, matters, blah, 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 whatever legally they spoke it. And I was just curious. Where did this go? I think she's a college student.
You raise a very interesting point, and it's a problem. It's a bit of a pet peeve of mine, because you are assuming that these lawyers are being paid. And maybe they are being paid, and maybe she is a relative of some wealthy person, and maybe they can afford that. But frequently in these kinds of situations, lawyers will take on the work for little or no direct compensation, or they'll do it basically on a promise of compensation. You know, they'll bill for the per hour, and they'll turn in invoices, but they won't expect to get paid because they know the client doesn't have any money. Their real compensation, from their point of view, comes from the publicity.
Okay.
And you see this over. Now, I'm not saying for certain that that's the case here, but if she doesn't have the money to afford these lawyers, then that's a good explanation for why they are, quote-unquote, being compensated indirectly.
So she could be represented by Sonny Bono's cousin, Pro.
I wouldn't quite call it pro bono, but it's close. I mean, again, you know, people will cling to a case with a lot of publicity because they love the limelight that comes with it.
I'm glad you brought this up because I just fits right in what we're talking about. And talking and watching Anderson Cooper, he brought on his legal expert, I think it's Michael O'Mara, the one who was the lead counsel for Zoom.
Mark O'Mara.
Mark O'Mara, I thought it was Michael. And I'm wondering, Peter, he's getting his publicity, as you just said. Does he also get paid by CNN to be a legal analyst, or is it all in publicity?
I don't believe he gets paid. Now, I don't know for certain. I think when they have those special things, you know, basically somebody, O'Meara gets a phone call from a program manager or assistant at CNN, and they say, look, we want to talk about this case. Can you agree to appear? You know, we'll put you in a local studio near your office or home, and, you know, we'll have a conversation with you. Will you be available to do that? And usually these guys say, absolutely, you tell me when and where. And they say things like, well, do you want a limo to pick you up? Do you need a limo? and you know, the guy shows up and he gets makeup and he does all that. And then he sits there and he answers some questions and he goes home. Now, I can't believe that he would be the kind of person who would be capable of commanding a fee for that kind of exchange. But if he was, then they might pay him. If he became a regular correspondent or contributor to CNN, they might pay him. But I think more often than not, you know, these guys are just happy to go on TV and talk about this stuff because it's publicity.
Okay, do you think that as an attorney, I can see exactly what you're saying, does Mark O'Meara, now he's getting publicity, is it his ego that wants to be fed, or is he hoping, and can it be demonstrated to these celebrity lawyers, become celebrity lawyers, that it does bring in a lot more money? Do you follow my question?
Yeah, I follow your question. I think that it's a little bit of both, personally, speaking from it personally. It's always very gratifying when people say, we want you to talk on TV and answer questions about a subject. That's always a thing that you enjoy doing, and it does feed the ego, as it would for anybody. If you're talking about a subject matter in which you're considered to have expertise, and you're basically getting free advertising, for instance, you know, if you are a criminal defense attorney and you specialize in representing defendants accused of crimes, and you're being asked to talk about a criminal prosecution of a person such as Amanda Knox, it's an opportunity for you to basically grandstand, to say, well, you know, I would have done it this way, this is the way it's handled, or blah, blah, blah. And people, when they're watching that, they have an immediate impulse to say, well, this guy must be a great criminal defense lawyer because he's talking on TV. And that is literally the way that people think about it. They literally think, this guy must be a great lawyer because he's talking on TV. It may or may not be true, but that's what people think. So it is very gratifying from a personal ego perspective. It can be, quite frankly, intoxicating from that perspective, because people go to you, wow, I saw you on TV, I saw you on TV, I saw you on TV, and everybody treats you differently after they see you on TV. You get the whole world treats you differently. You'd be amazed. But it also can translate to money if you're the kind of person who's capable of marketing as such. I was speaking with a reporter, actually, at a local TV news station last night, and she was telling me that lawyers in L.A. are much more media savvy than lawyers elsewhere, meaning, you know, there's this belief that you, as a lawyer, you can use the power of media to promote your case, help your case, benefit yourself, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's all of the above. It's all of the above.
Okay.
All right. I want to talk about the potential extradition. Italy is a, quote, friend, and we do have an extradition agreement with them. Now, Peter, I'm not trying to put you on the spot here.
Well,
but well, okay, yes,
I appreciate it. I see where you're going. Please go ahead.
Right now, what has happened in Italy goes completely against the grain of our double jeopardy rules. Do you
do you think that, you know, that there's a possibility that, you know, we will ship Amanda Knox off to Italy for 28 and a half years?
I would not completely rule out the possibility of it, but to me, it becomes a very interesting game that's played at the level of the State Department, because if there are people in Italy that we want to get extradited back to the U.S., you know, I forget his name. Who was it? Was it Polanski who allegedly committed a murder here in the U.S.?
Roman Polanski, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are people. His name just came to mind, but, you know, it feels like I'm trying to recall from my memory bank some Lifetime television movie about some, you know, bastard who kills some woman here and then runs off and lives in Europe somewhere, and they won't extradite him. So for me, it comes down to a very difficult kind of like a trading scenario. You know, if there's somebody that we want in Italy and we want the Italians to extradite him or her back to the U.S., well, it's very easy for the Italian government to say, well, what about Amanda Knox? And it becomes a difficult game to play. If you want somebody, you can't expect them to serve them up on a silver platter if you're holding out somebody. And I wouldn't put it past the Italian system or any system, not just Italian, but American as well. I wouldn't put it past the system to have some degree of bias in favor of making or finding a guilty verdict just so it could be able to play this game of poker. I'm not saying that's what happened, but that wouldn't surprise me, because at the end of the day, these are people. And there are people who are jostling for position, maneuvering, trying to move pieces on a board. They're trying to get what they want. And, you know, I think that's the game that's being played right now at a State Department level. If we don't assist in extraditing Amanda Knox, we can't expect much assistance in trying to get someone on their soil who we want back on ours. That's just standard quid pro quo, unless there are other poker chips being played, you know, other forms of consideration or exchange. But as a straight up deal, that, you know, if we're not going to get somebody from them, if we're not going to turn over somebody they want, and they may not want to waste it on Amanda Knox, they may want somebody else. But I think that's the way the game is going to be played at an Italian U.S. State Department level.
You know that sounds remarkably like the old Cold War deal. You know, I'll give you my spy if you give me your spy back, or the other way around.
I think that's right. I mean, unfortunately, a spy presumably understands when they go overseas on a mission that, you know, they're basically engaging in paramilitary activity, and like any soldier, they understand that their life can be forfeit. They're an asset. And if somebody is held captive, they can become a bargaining chip, if you will. There's a same kind of rationale afoot if you go overseas and are involved with and ultimately found guilty of some type of homicide crime or any other serious crime. You can be subject to extradition. Now, some of the exceptions to this are ones we talked about, I think, a while ago with respect to ambassadors and things of that nature. But generally speaking, when you commit a crime on the soil of another state or another country, that state or country on which the crime was committed on behalf of its citizens has the right to prosecute you, hold you, and detain you. And if you escape justice by going back to some other country, then you get into this exchange system. In my opinion, that's what you get into.
Sam, do you have any thoughts on the
I have no idea about extradition laws. I guess it'll probably be dictated on what the politics of the day are. I mean, maybe, you know, and you know what people are looking for, or maybe there is a smoking gun in this saga. I mean, I've seen, not knowing that much about it, and just you know, glancing over it, and I was amazed at how I saw those that were pro Amanda Knox, a former FBI agent, investigator, detective, passionately defending her, and those that were anti-Amanda Knox, again, detectives and former FBI agents and whatnot, I mean, ripping her to shreds, I mean, and the whole thing. It was amazing. I mean, I really felt the pro and con, that whole crossfire. I mean, there's people really going at each other and feel the whoever it is. And so that amazed me, how much passion that this case brought in with people who were mostly investigators. I didn't see any family members interviewed or friends. It was people who were pro Amanda Knox and anti, and they all had legal, police, detective work or whatnot in their backgrounds. So me, I think it's just, politically, it'd be whatever expedient, what the flame, someone was presumably in charge of expediting, if it comes to that, to stick the fingers in the wind, and whatever way the wind is blowing, that'll probably happen. So is the way the world runs on celebrityism right now. If she's supposed to be expedited and Justin Bieber beats up the cabbie, she may get away with it.
You just made the perfect segue. Right? Justin Bieber, a 19-year-old with more money than brains, just keeps finding ways to get into trouble. He's facing felony egging charges. I'm sorry, I can't even keep a straight face at that one. In California, drug use and drag racing in Florida, and earlier this week, charged with an assault on a limo driver in Toronto. Peter, would you have him as a client?
Well, there are many people who think that he would be a great client, and, just hearing these facts alone, I would not say, I would not turn him down. I think he very clearly needs help. He needs a lawyer, and I would certainly consider taking him as a client. Absolutely. Especially given the fact that he seems to have some ability to pay the bills, which is very important. And that's always
you wouldn't take him pro bono.
He needs a professional. He needs to pay for a professional, and he needs somebody who will really sit him down and tell him what needs to be done. And this is a problem, I think, with many celebrity-type figures, is that they are so used to getting what they want and being surrounded by an entourage of people who basically fawn all over them and tell them what they constantly want to hear, that they become spoiled, immature people, and they make bad decisions. And I think also, quite frankly, this behavior that he's exhibited is so erratic that it suggests that, he's drunk half the time or under the influence of something. But, I can't say for certain that that's true, but the behavior is very erratic. So he really needs someone with a strong hand and who's going to tell him what to do and make him get cleaned up. I don't know if he's going to find that, but I would certainly consider having him as a client. He's not going to hire me, but I would certainly consider it.
I'd consider making him a celebrity bartender.
Wouldn't he be great for that? Well, he's gradually working himself into the stage of existence where he's basically just a celebrity wind-up monkey. You just pull him out and, get some laughs at him.
He's 21, right?
19.
I thought he was 21. Okay. Lindsay Lohan was about 19. Miley Cyrus, not Lohan because she's kind of yesterday's news now. But Miley Cyrus and Bieber, at one point, they were all I'm just going from a marketing standpoint as you were talking, Peter. They, at one point, were 13-year-old Mickey Mouse Clubber type people who had a following of younger people. Those people have all gotten older. They're 19, 20, 21. They want to see Justin Bieber drag race. They're not buying his old candy, cotton candy songs, and they want to see Miley Cyrus gyrate her hips. Again, that age group, they're all growing up too. They're doing the similar things. You think this is just about becoming a bad boy image, a bad girl image, because it's going to help sell more records, more paraphernalia, more, you know what I mean?
Well, when I think of Miley Cyrus, I think of her making more calculated decisions about what she's going to do and how it's going to promote her popularity. You can say what you want about that performance at whatever awards that was. I forget what it was. What was that called? Tweaking, twerking? But that was calculated. I mean, she planned that. It's funny.
I agree with you.
We're looking at the 10-year anniversary of the famous nipple slip, the wardrobe malfunction at the Super Bowl. That was calculated. These are examples of women who are basically trying to get spotlight attention by, among other things, trying to market and sell their sexuality. Bieber, on the other hand, I mean, he's just out of control. I mean, I don't think he's making calculated decisions at all. He's a guy who, if somebody doesn't set him straight, he's gonna be a casualty, or he's gonna do something really, really bad. These are all warning signals of a guy whose life is spinning out of control.
So he's sort of like we agree on Miley, and we think Bieber is more like a male version of Lindsay Lohan at this point on his way.
I think he's fundamentally out of control, and I think he's, you know, I hesitate to say it because he doesn't evoke much sympathy, but he's not intentionally making a cry for help, but these acts are the acts of someone who needs help. He clearly needs help. He's spinning out of control. And I've heard stories about him before this occurred. Before these two incidents occurred, there have been stories trickling about him engaging he lives in some community. I think it's in Florida, but I'm not sure. But it's a wealthy community.
Yeah, South Beach.
Yeah, he lives in South Beach in a wealthy community, and there are some athletes who live there as well, and they were complaining about him drag racing through the neighborhood and threatening to hurt their children. And there was an incident where he did something with a hockey team or something. I forget what it was. But, he's been engaging in more out-of-control behavior. I don't think he's in control of himself right now. Miley, on the other hand, she may be kind of a nut, but I think she's very intentionally trying to market herself, as you say. He's just out of control. He's gonna destroy his marketability if he hasn't done it already.
Okay, there's a piece of me that says, where are the adults in all of this? Or, you know, are the adults actually enabling him in a way to generate, you know, more interest? Because there's an old saying, you know, there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Well, I've heard that saying before. I'm not sure I buy it. But, that question reminds me of an old Star Trek episode. And it was a classic. It was some guy on some planet had this incredible power. And he would, you know, the Starship Enterprise was cruising by, and he seized it, and he brought several of the people down, and he basically made them do whatever he wanted them to do, dance, play, do theaters and all that. And you thought he was this big malevolent guy. Well, it turned out he was just some wild, rebellious teenager, and he came from some world where they were great, powerful beings, and at the end of the episode, his parents show up, and they basically scold him and take him away. Pardon me?
Was that Tremaine?
I don't know the episode.
Campbell played the character. That was a great one.
A dark-haired guy?
Yeah, that was thought that William Tremaine was called Tremaine, and at the end he was whining to go home, and his parents said,
He didn't want to go home.
Okay, I'm just on a side note here, because Simon will love this. His wife was Judith Exner Campbell. What's she famous for, Simon?
Oh, you've missed me.
William Campbell, who played the part that Peter's talking about, which is a great analogy you're making, Peter. His wife was a movie actress, very good looking. Her name is Judith Campbell, or Judith Exner Campbell. She is famous for not just being this guy's wife, but the mistress of John F. Kennedy and Momo Giancala.
Oh, boy.
Now, that's a Trivial Pursuit.
That's a good one.
Okay,
anytime you can work, the word mistress into a sentence, it's always a good thing.
That is why I love this program. I never know what piece of trivia I'm going to pick up. But Peter, back to you. Back to your diatribe.
Well, I just feel like I'm not sure. I mean, everybody who's a parent, anybody who's been around young children, knows that they're very hard to control at certain ages and certain times. Now, if these kids, part of what keeps the kids under control is the fact that they don't really have the power to rebel. I mean, they've got to have a roof over their head. They've got to be fed. They've got to go to mom and dad to get anything. There's a control mechanism in place. But if you are a kind of kid who, at a very early age, you suddenly have unlimited power, unlimited money, you don't need to borrow mom and dad's car. You don't need to go to mom and dad for allowance. You don't need mom and dad to help you pay for college. You don't need mom and dad to put food on the table. So you're incredibly powerful and independent, but you're also incredibly immature and undeveloped, just like that alien creature in the Star Trek show. I mean, this guy had unlimited power, but he was really just a spoiled kid. And so, I don't know to what extent parents can actually control kids at this age who have this kind of power. And then that begs the next question of what in fact are these parents actually trying to do to control their children? And I don't know if they're doing anything or not, but, I get the feeling that the Cyrus family may be demonstrating or exercising a little bit more control over Miley than anybody is over Justin, but that's just a gut feeling,
Sam, you got any more?
Oh, yeah, Peter, I do. I'm sorry I brought that sidebar, but that was an knowing that episode, it was an excellent analogy. And I applaud you for that. My ex-wife was a drug addict, really bad, bad. And I, for years, you brought up that key word, Simon, called enabler, which I was chief enabler number one until I learned about a disease affects not just the addict, but those around it, until everyone can get a grip on it, and those to get a grip on it recover. Because one of the great things about, addicts is if everyone gets involved and really works hard, the addict does survive, and there's tons of men and women and families that have gone through this and survived and became better people because of it. In Bieber's case, and I think Lohan's case too, and others, it doesn't seem to be that, because I think it is all about enablers, the entourage, maybe the parents. I don't know what he's worth, $100 million. And the money's got to be such an enticing thing that this 19-year-old kid, buzzed out of his brains, can go up to his father or his mother or whoever his guardians and say, hey, fuck you, pardon my language, don't you tell me what to do. I just gave you $50,000 last week. I just bought you a house. I just did that. And that money probably is the ultimate weapon that kid swings with his entourage, who's ever in that entourage. I saw a picture of him. He was in Panama after the drag racing incident, and the crowd, it looked like a central casting for a Hollywood movie of a bunch of misfits. None of them seemed to fit, but they all were hanging around him and this and that, and he was walking around on this beach in Panama with no care in the world. You could just tell from his body language. And here's a kid who I thought he was 21, so at 19, it's terrible. That he was he was out of care in the world because he got all that money.
All right. There's also another very minor issue. I use that term loosely.
That's funny, I get it.
I could be wrong, but I suspect that he is in the U.S. on either an O or more likely a P visa. It's a working visa, but it's sharply limited. I'm pretty certain that the average P visa holder would have been thrown out of the country. Does his earning power supersede the law? Peter?
Well, Simon, if you ask the question in that way, I have to tell you that the answer is no. That's the stated official answer. The answer is no, of course not. The law does not care how much a person earned. The reality, however, is that directly or indirectly, all of that does have a way of coming into play. There are lots of ways it manifests itself. There are two alleged crimes that I know or understand to have been committed here in regards to Bieber. And one was this incident, which apparently occurred in Canada. Now, my understanding is he's a Canadian citizen by birth. So that's you described it as an assault. I don't know if it was eggs or snowballs or if he threatened to beat somebody up, which seems far-fetched to me because I think he's probably a little kid. He certainly seems that way to me. So I don't know to what extent an incident like that on foreign soil would have an impact on his visa status. And the other one, if I'm not mistaken, was a DUI. Is that right?
Well, no. There are actually
speeding.
Three. Right.
Okay.
Toronto involves slapping a limo driver around. California involves egging a neighbor's house. Florida involves, a DUI, drag racing, a yellow Lamborghini, just for fun, there's some question about the driver's license he was using. So,
well,
those are his problems.
You know, individually, any one of these things would not amount to very much. Although I must say, DUI is a very serious offense, not because of what it could happen when it happens, when you're under the influence behind the wheel. But the drag racing charge, to me, is the most serious of all, because that really shows a reckless disregard for human life. And that is a very serious thing. If anybody had gotten killed during that drag racing, he'd be looking at a very long jail sentence. That's called vehicular manslaughter. Any individually, none of these things I don't think would matter, because in the most serious crimes there were fortunately, thank God, no casualties or serious injuries, and these other crimes are just petty things that teenagers do. The individual things don't seem to add up enough to affect his visa status, although I'm not an expert. But collectively, it's starting to pile up here, and I don't know to what extent his visa is conditioned on that, but I do know that he's certainly able to hire the finest lawyers he can to represent whatever rights he's got to maintain his status. And typically, systems, legal systems, human systems, political systems bend over backwards to help someone like this because he's a cash cow, he's a celebrity, he helps put a lot of money in a lot of people's pockets, he's an industry in and of himself. But that can change very quickly, and I think that he's eroding his marketability is what I think's happening. And in the not too distant future, if he keeps up this kind of behavior, he may very well have his visa status revoked.
Sam, any thoughts on that?
I didn't know he ate somebody's house in California. Peter, isn't that the death penalty?
I really should be in this state. You know?
Oh, it's worse than that. I mean, we're talking Calabasas.
You know what those? Oh my God! He egged a Calabasas. Oh my gosh! Those things, that stuff really sticks to paint and stuff. That's terrible offense.
Right. Boy, well, if he egged someone's house in Calabasas. Oh, I'm surprised. I'm surprised the SWAT teams weren't called in and everything else. I'm surprised he survived that.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'm surprised the homeowner didn't pull out his assault rifle and take him out right there, because that, you know, that seems like gun country to me.
Yeah.
No,
here
is the thing. The house owner is claiming that $20,000 of damage was done, and that moves the egging into a felony.
Interesting. Well,
that homeowner must have one good public adjuster.
It all depends on how you're measuring damage. Now, I don't know if almost everybody's been involved in a fender bender, and you know, you get tapped from behind, and or you back into something, and you got a dented fender. You can go to a body shop, and the body shop says, "Is this going to be covered by insurance?" And if you say yes, well, I got to take the whole bumper off. You know, I got to do this, got to do that. And then suddenly you got a $3,000 or $4,000 bill. But if you say to the guy, "Look, it's not going through insurance. I'm only going to pay this out of cash. You know, just pull out the dent, and you know, maybe you can get that for $500 or $1,000." Sounds to me like somebody got egged, and now they want their entire house painted, or something like that. And I don't know if it's
knowing
if it really
houses in Calabasas, that you know, that could, you know, knowing a, that could be. It all depends what type of damage the eggs did to the house, what kind of siding it was, or this or that. And obviously they want the eggs and they want to eat it too, I guess. But and they're probably
They could just paint over the eggy parts and try to make the paint match. But you know, Calabasas, that's not going to go. So you got to do I'm sure that you know, somewhere down there, somebody's saying, "Well, we got to do this whole thing now to fix this."
Oh, absolutely.
We've got to tear the entire house down and rebuild it.
I will see, but as far as them pulling a visa, money talks and bullshit walks, and again, I don't think the president even they'll do that anything for him. They'll wait to see how the cases play out in the local courts and. We'll go from there. Meanwhile, I do agree with, at first I kind of thought maybe some of this was just to change his bad boy image, but I didn't know about the aching. I didn't know about the beating up, the drag racing in his home. I mean, obviously, kids got problems, and he's probably been a lot more incidents that we do not know about, and he's probably bought his way out of it or whatever, and maybe he is an accident waiting to happen, and I guess time will tell.
Okay, let's move on. And I'm going to aim this one straight at you, Sam. The State of the Union address, Obama basically claimed the pen is mightier than Congress. You must have just been hotter than a pepper sprout.
Well, I didn't watch it, okay? Because what the heck was I watching? Dog with a Blog with my granddaughter. Much more fun show. It's a Disney Channel. It's very witty, and she enjoys it. And I was babysitting that night. So I think the State of the Union to me is only important when a president first elected. Obama's first, and then would have been January of 2009, I watched it. I watched it one last year after he won re-election in 2012. Now, to me, he's already a lame duck. He became a lame duck faster than George Bush did, and George Bush was a lame duck pretty quickly. But it doesn't surprise me, as I've said many, many times to people, and I study this, is the second American president.
Peter. Peter, yes. Did you watch it or at least read about it?
I did not watch it, but I did read about it. And, you know, it's standard political rhetoric. I mean, it's what you get when you get the State of the Union. You get, you know, window dressing and cliches strung together. I used to think that a Hollywood screenplay was just a string of cliches. You know, you get a cliche, you attach it to another cliche, you attach it to another cliche, you weave in a few plot characters, you put in a few people in there, and suddenly you got a movie script. And to a certain extent, I view speeches in by politicians the same way. It's just a string of cliches, and I don't fault any politician for you know, turning a public address into these types of things, because that's what it is. That's all it is. It's a pep talk, and it's a dialogue, and it means nothing, because words that are spoken don't mean anything unless actions follow them. And I don't even know why we have a State of the Union address. It seems so pointless to me. But it's tradition, and America wants to see its president, and they want to hear good things, and they want to have some warm and fuzzy thoughts to hold on to. And I don't fault him for any aspect of it, and I think he meant what he said, and he's trying to achieve those ideals. But it's a speech by a politician. How valuable could it possibly be?
Obama's, and it's window dressing, and there's nothing wrong with that. I agree with you, Peter. He's speaking, you know, he's waving, he throws red meat to his, you know, red meat to his hungry followers, you know, and to his other ones, he puts up a stop sign. And the Republicans do it, the Democrats do it. I totally agree with you. Then the problem is, after the president speaks, you then have 435 mini State of the Union addresses. You have every Republican and Democratic House and Senate runs to the TV cameras to tell the local community what they thought of the State of the Union. So you got to hear it all over again. You know, I mean, that's the boring part.
It's
and the music
funny.
Just, yeah.
It's funny. It's a lot like watching a football game, okay? Now, apparently there's some big game on today, okay? So all day long before the game starts, they'll have about 12 hours of highlights, highlights of past Super Bowls, highlights of this season, highlights of these guys catching passes and falling down and stubbing their toes. And then after, the game's going to take – it's going to be a three-hour telecast, you know, only about 2 hours of that will be actual game time. And of the 2 hours of game time, there'll only be about 10 or 15 minutes of real action plays that matter. I've watched people condense a football game to 5 minutes, and you feel like you've got every nuance of the whole game because that's the only action there was. And then after the game ends, we'll see replays of this game probably for a full 24-hour period. And, you know, everything is more about the hype before it and around it and after it than it is what says there. But I just think it's funny with the State of the Union when they go to the highlight film and watch what Obama said here, and then they show you a snippet of what he said here. All we need is a little telestrator going, here are the words coming out of his mouth, and this is what they say. Watch him run this gap. See how he runs the daylight here?
Yeah. And they've hyped it, you know, and I think, you know, like, this guy's trying to save a second term, and his downfall is going to be his continuing going an end around around Congress. Republicans that he just can't do, and he gets snowballed, and that's it. You know, he can't do that. He's continually, you know, like he's I am amazed that this guy gets into office, constitutional attorney. Peter, I'm not going to pick on lawyers now. I am amazed at how many people have legal background, very good legal background. Nixon was another one, Duke University, and all this sort of stuff. And as soon as they get in, they use their legal mind to use the laws, to manipulate the laws, to get what they want to do. And that's what Obama is trying to do with the Constitution and appointments and this and that. And he manipulates the Constitution. George Bush did with the Patriot Act. He's had other people do it. Nixon. With all his crazy things, that these people who are well versed in law and respect the law and uphold the laws do it in
well,
butt talk when they get in.
It's very
and that's what Obama threatened to do. That's what Obama threatened to do. That.
What did he threaten to do exactly? What did he threaten to do?
go around Congress. He wanted a year of action. What do you call it, Simon? The year of action, 2015.
Yeah, year of action.
Year of action.
Yeah, I boil it down to the pen is mightier than Congress.
Right.
You know, what exactly does that mean to you guys? What does that mean?
Executive orders. He wants to go crazy with executive orders.
Well, go get them then. More power to them.
That's the imperial presidency that has been, you know, it's funny, since 19, after Nixon, after Watergate, Republicans and Democrats in Congress and the courts came together to limit the power of the imperial presidency for many, many reasons. War Powers Act was one of them, some other things out there, and yet, and they were instituted under certain presidents, and other presidents have been able to run amok with executive power. So it's probably, as Simon said, it's who the pen is making a check out to, and they buy everything, and that's what I think what the problem is here. Is,
have you seen a movie? It's a you know, post apocalyptic sci-fi movie called Oblivion. Have you seen that?
Which one was it called?
It's called Oblivion. It's got Morgan Freeman and Tom Cruise in it.
No, I have not.
Well, you need to see it, because this is a page right out of your book. It's all about how the insidious powers of the forces that supposedly are on our side can take advantage of distress. And there's lots of drones in it, lots of drones. I always think of you when I watch this movie, because there's lots of these evil drones running around.
I think the president shouldn't. You know, I think executive orders are. Look, they started out probably as a good thing, as most things. Look, I believe most government programs started out with good intentions, but the road to hell is paved with good intentions, as the saying goes, and that's what happens. And, you know, and I think that if he can't govern his way, the right way, I mean, the impression you get from Obama is, because he had such a crappy year last year, he lost the war and he won. Obamacare turned out to be a real mess in getting started. It's still, you know, the wheels are still falling off that website. The jury's still out on it, but just getting to it going is still a nightmare. So he had all these bad things happen to him, and Congress is stalemated, and his government shut down. So he's going to, and like you said, Peter, he just, does he really mean to do all that stuff? Probably not, because he knows he can't do it. He's only done as much as he possibly can do, but he has to throw the red meat to the starving dog, and that was to his liberal base to say, I'm going to fight these nasty Republicans, because you know what? Everyone forgets what's really taking place right now. Two things: Obama's a lame duck, and there's a huge election coming up in November, and these guys all want to be reelected.
Okay, a question for both of you: is it even possible for Obama to get anything achieved this year?
I just don't think he's going to get reelected.
Yeah, but that's 2016.
Oh, come on. That's a funny one. Is it possible for him to get anything done? Yeah, I think it is. I think everything is going to be a fight, and I think something like Obamacare, it's just a classic example. I just think that was such a tempest in a teapot. I really do. So much hand-wringing and ranting and raving, and at the end of the day, I think Obamacare is going to quickly recede into the past, and people are going to wonder what all the fuss was about 2 or 3 years from now.
If it's working. If it's working.
I think it's going to work. I think it's already
working. Well, then you've answered your own. I agree with you. If it works, no one will give a shit. If it's a failure, people are going to be beating it. They'll be beating it from pillar to post.
We'll look back at Obamacare as one of the, in my opinion, one of the great transcending moments in our history, a time period when we basically mandated a system of minimum health insurance for every American, and we'll wonder why we didn't do it sooner. I'm saying 2 or 3, 4 years from now, that's what people will say. Like, why on earth, how could you even have had a system that was any way else? But that's my opinion. We'll see. Can he get anything done? Yeah, I think he can get stuff done, but you're right, Simon. On the whole, he's going to encounter intense opposition because I think the Republican Party is absolutely terrified and scared out of its mind. I think they're engaging in reckless behavior, and I think they will stop at nothing to lie down in front of what they perceive to be an oncoming train of destruction because they're terrified. They're acting like terrified people. We will filibuster the Senate. We will shut the government down. You know, they're acting scared.
The government's not going to get shut down. They've already cut their deal. That's yesterday's rhetoric, Peter. They already cut a deal to make the budget. They're done. Now, the biggest story coming is what? What's happened in the last 3 weeks that everyone's not paying attention to? We ourselves were spending more time talking about Justin Bieber, Amanda Knox, the Super Bowl, and the State of the Union that was a pretty boring speech from what I heard. Something's happened to the stock market over the last 2.5 weeks. Dropped 1,200 points. Why has it dropped, Simon and Peter?
Peter and Simon, I'm talking about my two profits.
I think that's easy to answer. All right? I heard that the Fed stopped feeding or slowed down, you know, feeding money into the system. Stock market, I think, had 50 days in 2013 where it hit, you know, new highs. And sure, investors are going, uh-oh. Good times are over. Get out.
Right before the holidays, it almost hit up 17,000 points. You're right. Record highs. Then Bernanke started to tone it down. It's now dropped down to 15.5. And it's going to start dropping because they're running out of paper to print the money on. That's going to be the thing that's going to dictate what the hell's going to happen in this next election is Republicans or Democrats, you guys better do something about this economy. And it's not, you know, because the economy has been in sputtering around and existing on printed money by the Fed to Wall Street, $85 billion a month that propped up all this craziness. And that's what's going to happen. I've been saying this, and so have you, Simon, is that, you know, for a couple of years now. So you got to stop printing the money, and you know, and they just keep giving away stuff and giving away stuff. And the Chinese market, the third world emerging markets, whatever the hell they call them, they're not buying. They're all tanking too, and it's going to be a mess coming. Another bubble is coming. The bubble that everyone said was going to come is coming again. It's going to happen this year, and it's already started to. And that's why Bernanke's getting out, and people better be. Better be careful. It's not just the Republicans are to blame, and so are the Democrats to blame. And it's going to be a huge issue coming these elections. What are we going to do? Are we going to continue to have government spending, government stimulation that doesn't work, never has, never will, or are we going to create jobs and do things? And we haven't been able to, guys. We've created jobs in Mexico, South Korea, China, India, and all that stuff because our corporations have moved the headquarters over there. They buy and sell the politicians, and the American people are getting screwed. And I tell you, it's not a Republican or a Democratic thing. It's a Washington D.C. thing to stick at the Main Street. You know, I'm going to give you a little. I got a heads up. At my bar, we have some General Motor workers there. Do you know what the bonuses are going to be in about 2 months? It's going to come out, and Americans are going to absolutely freak out. Okay? Do you know what the profit-sharing bonus from Government Motors to the very limited UAW workers are going to be?
Mm-mm.
Take a guess, guys. Last year was $5,000 a pop, which I thought was outrageous, without them paying back the taxpayers. Guess what the taxpayers are paying every worker in the UAW in the United States in April? $18,000 a pop.
No
They're
way.
All going to get 18 grand from guys from working schmucks who on Main Street who never got a penny but paid into that, and you know, and that's going to be devastating politically to the people who bailed, to both parties and those that bailed them out, because that's not what it's really supposed to have. It's picking winners and losers with taxpayers' money. And I was against the bailouts back then, and I even more so today when I hear that, because the cars they make are crap, and I get into these arguments with people. They go, the domestic auto industry would have collapsed. Not so. Ford Motor Company wouldn't have collapsed. That's the last time I checked. Ford's located in Detroit. But that's gonna, you know, that's just as bad. When AIG guys got their hundreds of thousands of dollars a pop, or the Wall Street gold people got hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars. That's what we created with this so-called stimulus, the so-called priming the pump, QE1, QE2, QE3. Very few people are benefiting from it. And they're benefiting great for it because they're connected. They're wired in. They got the juice. The rest of America is not, and it's going to be hell to pay at this ballot box come November. I don't know what's going to happen. Peter, I'm for national health care. I think that Obamacare potentially was the right step in the right direction. It boggles my mind that they've flubbed it and with all the time they had and whatnot, and it's still not consumer-friendly enough for me. I know people are still trying to, you know, wade their way through the system and whatnot, and I can't believe we're in our tech-savvy world with all these geniuses from great colleges and businesses that we couldn't get it right. And that bothers me, and because that's what we pay. You know, the return on the investment is terrible. And not just at the federal level, it's at the state level, it's at the local level. And, you know, we Americans really, we're all belly up to the bar. We pay our fair share, not just in income tax, property tax, gas tax, oil tax, sales tax, usury fee taxes, right? I mean, how many taxes do we pay? We pay a lot. And we all do it because we all know hopefully that's going to go for the better good. And everyone's going to kind of have a trickle-down effect from generation to generation. That's what we want. That's what I'm for. And it's just not getting there. And we're being raped, pillaged, and plundered by two robber baron parties that get worse, don't get better. And I really hope that this year, the year of 2014, is a year of grassroots, pitch and fork on fire, and America takes back its government.
Well, I like pitch and fork and on fire. That's a great image. I see poor Frankenstein being burned in the castle. I love it.
Well, that's a good one. Hey. Think about it. All these, Dr. Frankenstein was a monster, something created by, let's use that analogy. The government created a policy named Frankenstein. Frankenstein came back to destroy the mass, but the people had to get in the way. But anyway,
awesome.
I still like the Tremaine one better.
Yeah, I still like it. That was right on. That was spot on. I can still see him at the end. I don't want to go home. That was so perfect.
And it was a real shocker to the audience too, right?
Yeah, that was the whole point, is that you didn't realize that this powerful being was actually in the eyes of another superior race. It was just a child.
Right,
from our point of view.
Great.
Yeah, and at the end, it totally caught you by surprise that this guy was just a baby. But that
Gene Roddenberry was one hell of a writer.
Sure knew what he was talking about.
He really, I mean, all that stuff. I mean, he wrote some great stuff like that. If I may take another, Peter, do you remember the one about when they went to the Spock, and it was the one that had the first interracial kiss in television history between Kirk and O'Hara?
They got sprayed with those flowers or whatever?
Yeah, you remember the midget was in it? Michael Donnelly. What?
Was he the Irish guy who liked to fight Kirk?
No. There was this one. It was like a Roman society. And the Roman people had, those that were Roman, had superpowers from eating some food or something, and they all, and the midget, they treated like their slave, and he never realized he had to, because he ate the same food, they had beaten him up so many years mentally and abused him, he never realized he had the same power that they had from the food.
Great episode.
Yeah, and remember they made Kirk and Uhura kiss.
Yeah, those poor guys. Poor Kirk had to take one on the grenade for that
one.
He was waiting to do that every chance he could get.
He spread his seed all over the universe.
He sure looks fat and happy these days. I got to tell you, he looks like one fat happy camper.
There's a guy who, what he has done as a pitchman, you know, for what he does, and I love the way he makes fun of himself.
He just looks
at the audience and winks and goes, it's almost like he's saying, can you believe they're paying me millions of dollars to do this?
Yeah, I got to tell you, I mean, what a great life. That guy, he is going to die one happy man probably 100 years from now.
Did you ever see him on Boston Legal?
I never saw – I saw bits and pieces of that show, and I saw his character a couple times, but I never really got into it and watched it.
I didn't get into it, but his character was fabulous.
Man,
I'm looking at the clock, and there's a couple of other subjects I would love to hear you both talk about. Bridgegate, the problem that's growing faster than Chris Christie is. You know, is he done as a contender in 2016? Sam, your thoughts?
Well, my son told me today. By the way, my son, I won't tell everybody, I pat him on his back. He's now working for Sports Illustrated. He just got hired. He's been there for 2 weeks. Poor guy, because he has to, because the Olympics coming up, he has to fill in for someone on the Sports Illustrated model shoot next month. I feel really bad for him. But anyway, he sent me a text. He's the one who told me that Philip Seymour Hoffman died. And also, the New York Times did a huge expose on Christie today. And I guess Christie went ballistic, and he's going to send me a link to that for the Super Bowl game today. But anyway, he was... I haven't had a chance to read it, but I think it appears that Christie, the smoking gun is there, that he didn't know about it, according to this one guy, and it looks like the bridge is sinking under his weight. And I think he's done as a contender to such a point. Because the establishment. Wait. He was. I can tell you he's done because Jeb Bush is thinking about getting in. I'm done with my comment.
All right, I loved your comment, and I'm going to come back to it. Peter, is Christie done in your book?
No, I don't think he's done. I'm not sure exactly what this is yet. I don't know. If they think they have a smoking gun on him and it turns out that he was, in fact, you know, lying through his teeth to everyone, then, yeah, that's probably a shot in the foot that'll be difficult to overcome. But anything short of that, anything short of real ironclad proof that he lied and tried to cover this all up, anything short of that, and I think that's just a bump in the road. But if they can truly show that, I mean, it's not even a big deal. It's also silly. But if he did lie about it and intentionally tried to conceal it and cover it up, that will be, I do think that will be a kiss of death for him. But if anything short of that, I don't think that'll impair him.
Mm. You know, Sam, I've been watching the Christie story unwind, or maybe the term is unravel. I actually like the guy, and you know, I lean left. I'm more than happy to. Say that, but you know he seems like seemed like a guy that you know genuinely cared.
Do you remember what Bill said a couple weeks ago? about Christie. Remember, he's a constituent of Mr. Christie, lives in New Jersey. And this is when Bridgegate opened up, and I said that in his, that it's not so bad that Bridgegate happened, knowing that they know his personality. They're not surprised it happened, et cetera, et cetera. But the finances of the state are kablooey. That's what's going to kill Christie. Right now, he's being covered. The state on his watch has become bad. Everyone thought it was really good. It's become bad. It's the finances. That's what's going to kill Chris Christie, because people are going to people are going to want a presidential candidate, who, whether it's Republican or Democrat, who's going to be able to come in there and fix this economy and fix the way the system isn't working for the American people. So I'm going to go with what Bill says, because, you know, he reads the papers, he sees the news, he knows more about it than we do. We get, you know, the three of us get, you know, watered down pieces of, you know, depending on what website we're reading or what newspaper or television show. I'm sure Fox News says Chris Christie is great, and MSNBC sends a tweet about Romney's black grandchild, and CNN talks about what a bad person he is, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But I think, knowing Chris Christie, as I said before, at earlier shows, where he comes from and what he's about, I have no doubt that he wasn't punishing that Democratic mayor, and has punished others. And you're going to see this is going to be, I think it's just unraveling politically, because that's the way we work in today's world. That's the way politics works. One issue, you know, he didn't kill anybody. He wasn't found that dead. You know, what was that old saying they used to say? A politician was only going to lose an incumbent if they were found with a dead girl or a live little boy. And we've gone way past that, gang. Now, you know, you look at all the scandals of men and women in power, political power, and, you know, something like, you know, a text message can bring them down. Something like ordering an aide to do something that the rest of Americans think is bad, might have been good to those people at the time. Anything can bring these people down at any given moment in a 24/7 news cycle. And that's why they have to be super duper careful, and they better have super duper wonderful people around them to protect them from themselves, because they're humans.
Okay, but let's talk about 2016. Maybe Chris Christie is off the ballot. And I think he would have done well. Who the hell are they going to field? I mean, there aren't many Republicans that are palatable these days.
Well, it's an interesting question. I guess one of the things that is kind of a related question that I keep thinking of is, if you think that Christie is under attack right now, that people are trying to destroy his political career, and I believe that's the case, where's the attack coming from? Do you think that the attack is coming from liberals and Democrats, or do you think it's coming from other Republicans who don't like his liberal agenda, or more liberal agenda, I should say, than most conservatives find palatable? I tend to agree with you, Simon. I kind of like the guy. So, you know, with that question sort of laying out there in the weeds, I don't know who they're going to get. And the bigger question is, who are they going to get who's going to be electable? And I'm not sure if Chris Christie was ever electable. I liked him, and I thought he was an interesting guy, and I don't mean to speak about him in the past tense, but I think probably, and this will be a nice segue to my esteemed colleague from Ohio, I think probably the next likely candidate, and he may have been the most likely candidate the whole time, is Rand Paul.
Thank you. I will tell you this, gentlemen. In 2005, which was 3 years away from the next election, right? Two years away. In 2006, if we were on a radio show and Peter Haven would have said, "Watch for this guy, Barack Obama, he's going to be president," I would have said, "Who?" So that being said, there's probably a Democrat and Republican that none of us know who could be potentially be a candidate who catches fire and wins their party's nomination. Do you agree with me on that?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Okay. So I think that's number one. So that's number one. Number two, I think Christie is done only because of I thought he still was alive a little and wobbling. We both wobble. But when I started to see that Jeb Bush now thinking about jumping into the race, despite his mother's warnings, that means Christie's done. They probably can't raise money because then they have to go to another establishment candidate. I do believe Rand Paul will be a very formidable primary candidate and is possibly going to win the next presidency based upon going after the Fed and the NSA. Those are two big issues to me. That might not sell in Peoria. I don't know. It does sell with me right now, but I think he's the most credible candidate. But when they do polls, CNN did a poll Wednesday night, Paul Ryan was on top. Now, there's a guy who was a nice guy, but a terrible. I thought he was him and Romney ran a terrible campaign, but he's winning, which is all goes back to name ID. And, Hillary Clinton is up by 80, she's got 80% of the vote in the Democratic primary, and Joe Biden was at 12%, and up. And Elizabeth, now here's the one to watch for the Republicans. I don't think Hillary's going to run because of her health and Benghazi and health first and all that. But I think the Democrats are going to nominate Elizabeth Warren as the president candidate in 2016.
Oh.
The senator from Massachusetts. I really do.
Oh, good Lord.
Well,
I think you guys have to realize the Democrats. I don't know about you, Simon and Peter, and you in your community. My community, the people who've taken over the Democratic Party since Obama got elected, are younger, aggressive, very. A lot of them have lots of degrees and whatnot, and they all work in the nonprofit sector that's funded by the Democratic Party or the federal government, state government, or whatnot. Republicans too. They're making an industry out of nonprofits too, and it's become a real growth factor in doing things. And the party has become here in Mahoning County really liberal. There used to be a lot of they call them blue dot Democrats. They were conservative Democrats on some issues and whatnot, and they could work together and with other people, and they searched out. But now, because of the total dominance of the Democratic Party here, they are ultra-left, just like part of the Republican Party dominance in communities is the hijacked by the Tea Party. So you have two really ideological, and I've noticed that. I said, geez, where are all these middle-of-the-road people, the ones who were just right on all issues?
Issues. That's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen
in a Star Trek episode.
Yeah, you're open-minded, okay? You're open-minded. I'm open-minded about a lot of things. I can be persuaded, trust me. Peter, I think you can be persuaded.
You're right. I can. I sometimes get there grudgingly, but I try
you,
to
you,
recognize.
You would go. You, I would go to places I didn't think I would go kicking and screaming, but I'd still go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, here's an interesting...
We don't have people like that anymore.
You're right. That's the problem. That's a real problem, in my opinion, in the world. It's very hard to admit that you didn't assess a matter correctly or to admit that your position has been changed. And I find that it is increasingly difficult. Maybe it's just always inherently difficult. Once people make up their mind, that's it. They're not budging. And it doesn't matter how much you convince them or persuade them that something should be looked at another way. They're just not going to do it. Simon's question and Sam's comment, this is according to the Christian Science Monitor, okay? Let's do a Letterman top 10 countdown in reverse. These are the top Republican candidates outside of Chris Christie starting – they list 14 of them, but I'm only going to do 10. Number 10 is John Huntsman, former governor of Utah, considered some sort of wunderkind. The next is Rick Santorum from Pennsylvania, according to the Christian Science Monitor. Next is Bobby Jindal, J-I-N-D-A-L, Louisiana governor. Okay, these are just all good old-fashioned white males right here. Jeb Bush, number 7. good old, you know, it's not politics unless you get a Bush in there. Scott Walker, the Wisconsin governor, who's considered a quote-unquote rock star, but they're not sure if he's going to run. Number five, Marco Rubio. Number four, Ted Cruz. That's Simon's favorite. That's the cruise control. Number three, my own personal non-favorite, because he lied about his marathon time, is Paul Ryan. That irks me. As a guy who's run two marathons, that just irks me. I'll never forget that. I will never forget that. And then the way he tried to patch over it, like, well, I just got a couple of numbers mixed up. And then number two is Rand Paul, and then Big Boy is Bob Big Boy. Can't you see him just holding up the hamburger? That would be great. That would be a great campaign.
Well, hey,
for Christy.
By the way, guys, Simon, Peter, you brought something up. Who's going after Christy? Is it those list of nine people or the Democrats? And someone just said, I just was reading, scrolling, the Democratic National Committee is blasting Christy with ads that have nothing to do with the Super Bowl. So I don't know what it is. Not that he screwed up the Super Bowl or this or that, but they're using football like analogy to talk about his career. So it's supposed to,
well,
so they're in commercials about him.
I guess if they're the one taking aim at him, then they must think he's the number one candidate on the Republican ticket. The Christian Science Monitor appears to rank him number one. I never really thought of him as the number one candidate on the Republican ticket, but maybe he is.
I'm laughing and sneezing, so that was the noise.
You would love to have Ted Cruz run, wouldn't you, Simon?
I'd be all over it.
I hope he runs and he realizes that when he gets 1% of the vote in Iowa, like John Hunchman did, that your presidential ambitions are over. Aspirations, excuse me. Didn't Huntsman speak Mandarin Orange or something? Mandarin Orange.
didn't Cruz, who was the guy? That's funny, Mandarin Orange. I'm fluent in Mandarin Orange. Who was the guy who just made the comment about, it was a Cruz comment about how Clinton was reprehensible because he took advantage of Monica Lewinsky. Was that what I heard correctly?
That was my
guy.
Anybody
recall that?
He called him a prep. He goes, why did Rand Paul and Cindy Crowley's thing a couple weeks ago said she started blasting why are Republicans why do Republicans have a have a war on women or something like that? And he said, you know, I don't understand why the Democrats get away with what they get away with. You know, where was the feminist when Bill Clinton was playing Predator in the
I think that's Clinton. Funny. Was that Rand Paul who said that?
Rand Paul said that.
I think that's
trying
funny.
To make the point that I think it was stupid that he brought it up. What?
That the Democrats were evil to women because Bill took advantage of Monica.
He said he doesn't like the double standard. He said that the women, where were the women?
What happened?
When Monica Lewinsky was taken, when the giant sucking sound was not Nathan Gad, it was Monica, okay? when she was, he said something like, he put his foot in his mouth because that's what Republicans do when they talk about these issues. But I understand what he was trying to say. It's a double standard. And then he went stupid and he goes, yeah, your brain lock time. And he goes, you know, look, women's groups rallied around Bill Clinton, who was a predator, in the Oval Office, and he was. You know, that's the worst thing I thought about him. I always thought the dumbest thing Bill Clinton did was, here you are, you're the President of the United States, you like to fool around, and you picked Monica Lewinsky to fool around with? That's what you should have been picked for.
That's what happens in Washington. Everybody looks better in Washington after you've been there for a while. That's just that's a town of bookworms. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah,
a hot ticket. That's like a hot ticket getting off the train in Washington. Like, holy cow, look at that.
Okay, Peter.
I think Rand Paul was making a good point about double standards, but he never should have brought it up the way he did. But look, you're running for president. You got to get out there and you got to say stuff.
I just think the comment. I think the comment was an insult to women because I think that the notion that Monica was taken advantage of is crazy. I think it was the other way around. I think she was just as much of a predator as Bill was, and I think it's an insult to women to suggest that somehow she was some helpless waif.
I think it was mutually assured sex, and that's it. I don't even know why you even brought it up. I don't know, but he did. And
I just thought it was funny because I couldn't help but think in the sounds of many women's ears, that would have been the, you know, they would have been thinking the exact opposite. But what do I know? What do I know?
Peter.
Hey, what happened to Monica?
Peter, you spent some time in Washington.
Yep.
Did you have your own little bunch of groupies?
Well, I sure tried, but I failed to succeed.
No, here's what you should have asked Peter. Peter, what cigar did you smoke?
Well, I didn't inhale. Let me give you my favorite story about Washington, D.C. I was in the Rayburn office building on the third floor, and I was two doors down from a guy who had an immaculate office. His office was immaculate. There was nothing in there except beautiful women who were working there. And I used to walk by this office, and everybody used to say, oh, he only hires attractive ex-Playboy playmates or whatever. And I used to walk by his office all the time because he had the most beautiful women working there, and I just couldn't stop looking at him. And this was back in the mid-'80s. And the name of that congressman was Charlie Wilson. And this was the height of his clandestine campaign, and all I could do was ogle at his staffers all the time. He was waging a single-handed war in Afghanistan, which I later learned in the movies. But, man, those were pretty women in that office.
That was an interesting story. His whole Charleston's War was an interesting story, great movie. And, Peter, I'm glad you got – did you get any?
No, I got nothing. I was just a kid fresh out of boot. I mean, I was right out of college. I just was sitting there, and they used to
catch me. How intimidating were those girls? How intimidating was that office?
They were stunning. And, you know, when you're just a kid out of college and you see these older women with those professional outfits on, I mean, it was awe-inspiring.
Okay, gentlemen, I do believe that our time is up. It has been a delightful afternoon. Sam, would you like to give us your parting thoughts?
I had a great time today. Thank you so much, Peter, Simon. It was a pleasure. We talked about funny stuff, good stuff. We all make great points. I learn something every Sunday. Now I'm going to be able to be a veg and go watch the Super Bowl. I believe Seattle's going to get defense, is going to get the taking, and they are going to win the game. And I will say this, there's a lot of celebrities right now holding their breath. So who's going to, because celebrity deaths come in third. Last night, the world lost Maximilian Schell, great actor. Peter, I'm sure as a lawyer, you loved his job as a defense attorney in Judge Unit Nuremberg. It was fabulous. Right? He won Academy Award for that. And as we all know, Philip Seymour Hoffman, another great actor who won an Academy Award for playing Truman Capote, died of an apparent drug overdose today. So bad for them, and that there's a third celebrity out there somewhere because it always comes in threes. Have a great Super Bowl weekend, everybody. Can't wait to see you next Sunday.
And, Peter,
well,
I'm sure you have some gems of wisdom.
Well, I just hope the third celebrity is not one of us. Because, you know, we're high up there on the ticket, too. I'm going to hold my breath as well. I hadn't thought about that, but now I'm worried. No, gentlemen, great day as usual. All the best. Happy, healthy, safe, sane Super Bowl Sunday. And go Hawkcos. That's my attempt to synthesize the Seahawks and the Broncos. I think the Broncos are going to win.
Do you?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're going to get the benefit of every call. I think the bad guys are the Seahawks and the good guys are the Broncos, as defined by their own teams. Everybody wants to see Peyton get the Super Bowl.
Oh, don't!
So
I hope it's not going to be a game that the referees decide. But Peter, you
well,
may be
I think, trust me, it'll come down, there'll be some question about an official decision, and I think that Peyton is clearly the sympathetic choice and that these guys are human and they can't help themselves, and so that's my theory.
Gentlemen, I do want to thank you both for taking part. And as always, it has been an illuminating program, and I do hope you will be back next week. Until then, goodbye.
We'll be back.